So, the Super Bowl of Indian philosophy will now begin. There are always people that like ritual, and then people who are more interested in knowledge. People just have different natures. And, in any religion you can find that. Some people just like to do rituals. They like all the ceremonies and everything. Other people are not into rituals, and they prefer to pursue philosophy and wisdom and so on and so forth. And these things are not mutually exclusive, because the wisdom people, let's say within a religious tradition, also tend to participate in some ceremonies, like they go to their friends' weddings, and, you know, sometimes on holy days they may go to a church or synagogue or Hindu mandir or mosque or whatever. So they're not mutually exclusive, but they're... These are two different emphases or different approaches. So, forever in Indian religions, there have been these two divisions. And the typical language used is karma. The word karma, which also means the reactions to your actions, you know, what happens to you based on what you do. But also, it's a simple Sanskrit word, means simply action. And kanda means division. So the Vedas are understood to have different divisions, and the ritual division. People concerned with rituals, performing rituals to get different kinds of blessings, such as, let's say, prosperity or health, things people typically pray for. The idea that certain activities are auspicious, ritually auspicious, and so on. So there's the ritual section of the Vedas, karma kanda, and then there's the jnana kanda over there. The knowledge section, people who are more concerned with wisdom and aren't that interested in rituals and ceremonies. It's not that they absolutely avoid them, but their path is more simply to cultivate knowledge and wisdom. So these are the basic two divisions of the Vedas. And if you remember the four Vedic Samhitas, the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda, Tara Veda, and then there is the commentarial literature talks about that sort of shop talk among Brahmins talking to Brahmins about the rituals. That's the Brahmin literature. That's why it's called that. And then you get the Aranyakas, which are sort of still rituals, but moving toward knowledge. Anyway, especially the four Vedic Samhitas, the four Vedas, and then the commentary, that's the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, typically. It's all about rituals and sacrifices and so on. And the knowledge section is, the Aranyakas. We talk about the Aranyakas, which people went out to the forest, part of the whole Shramana phenomenon. And then the Upanishads. The word Upanishad, and the Upanishads are typically the Jnanakanda. They're sort of like the center of the knowledge portion of the Vedas. Upa, in Sanskrit is, the Greek H is silent, like honor, or hour. Like what hour, how many hours, and so on. So, Sanskrit upa is just the Greek upo. This Y in Greek is like the U, it's like the letter U in French and German, U. And so the H is silent, so it's upo, which is just Sanskrit upa, same word. And you know, it means like not the full amount of something, like hypothermia, not enough heat, and so on. And so upa in Sanskrit, same word. It just means kind of like, it means near, not quite there, but near. So it can just mean proximity. And then ni means like down, and sat is just the English word seat. So Upanishads, to sit down near. And it's often understood to mean to sit down at the feet of a guru, sit down near your teacher. And the reason it has to be upa, the reason it has to be near, is because the Upanishads were typically secret doctrines. They were like esoteric knowledge, or things that were, there were some qualifications to receive the knowledge. In fact, if you look in other literature, other Sanskrit literature, sometimes they'll use the word Upanishad simply to mean a secret or esoteric doctrine. Anyway, those are the Upanishads. And there are originally eight very important Upanishads, and then there are different lists, like 16, 100, and Upanishads. They perhaps are still being written today. And people come in late, you might try the back door, because it's for obvious reasons. So, Anyway, the Upanishads. Now, the Upanishads are sort of the foundation of this Gyanakanda, this knowledge section of the Vedas. But there are other literature. So the whole apparatus, the whole Gyanakanda, the whole knowledge section of the Vedas is generally called Vedanta. Anta, just like the English word, is just the English word end. I mean, it's clearly cognate. So, and Veda is knowledge. Related actually to the English word video, by the way. The Latin vedere means to see. It's cognate with the English word veda, knowing, to know. And so our words like video, vision, etc., etc., the Spanish like vista, that's all related to the English word veda. Sanskrit word veda, and then German wissen, to know. English word wit, as in, you know, witty or dimwit or whatever. Wit is all, it's all related to the word veda. So veda anta, the end of knowledge. The end of knowledge is considered to be the culmination of the Vedas and the last part of the Vedas to be studied. So anyway, so in this Vedanta, in this end of the end of the Vedas, or the knowledge portion of the Vedas, there are basically three components. Actually, I left one out here. Whoops. Okay, I'm going to slightly adjust this here. Bhagavad Gita. These two kind of go together. So, I'll explain now. There, that's a better list. First of all, you have the Upanishads. And the Upanishads are technically classified in Hinduism, and everyone classifies it this way, as Shruti. The Sanskrit root shru means to hear, Shruti, which means like that which is heard, because the Vedas go way back before writing, before people used to write. It was simply heard, spoken by a guru to a disciple. So the Upanishads are the Shruti, and this refers to the oldest layer of Vedic literature. The original Vedas, the Brahmanas, Aranyakas, and Upanishads, that's called Shruti. And that always had a certain prestige. It's like that's the oldest. Bless you. That was the oldest literature and kind of like the most authoritative, although in practice, people just kind of bow to it and then go on reading other books. But anyway, so the Shruti is the oldest and in a sense the most venerated level of literature. And then you have Brahma Sutras. The Brahma Sutras, sutra is English word suture. It means a thread. And so the Brahma Sutras are perhaps the most sophisticated philosophical work within the Hindu tradition. And a sutra is a very condensed little pithy thing, like a short saying that needs commentary. And so there are grammar sutras, there are philosophical sutras, there are ritual sutras, all kinds of sutras. Imamsas had their sutras. But the Brahma sutras about the absolute, by the way, the word Brahma, in the Upanishads, the basic theme is Atma, the self or the soul, and Brahman, the absolute. The Sanskrit root vri, in case you're interested, means to grow or to become great. And so from this root you get the word Brahman, meaning like the greatest. And so the Brahma Sutras are these very sophisticated, short sutras, which talk about the absolute truth, which talk about the Brahman, the absolute of the Upanishads. And in a sense, the Brahma Sutras are considered to be a commentary on the Upanishads. Because there's so many Upanishads, they talk on different topics, they take different approaches, and sometimes, at least superficially, appear to be promoting different points of view. Therefore, in order to organize all of this, to make it all coherent, to figure out what the Upanishads ultimately mean, what's the conclusion of the Upanishads, that's what the Brahma Sutras claim to be doing. And so, the Brahma Sutras are considered to be Nyaya, which in Sanskrit means logic. And so sometimes they're called, for example, prasthana means like a point of departure. So the Upanishads are departing from the point of Shruti, this oldest Vedic literature, and then the Brahma Sutras are considered to be the Nyaya prasthana, which is simply the application of logic, the application of tradition, of say, faithful scholarship and logic to the Upanishads. That's the Brahma Sutras, also called the Vedanta Sutras, by the way. And then finally there's the Bhagavad Gita, which is the single most important book, actually, in the history of Indian religion, in terms of actually having the most influence on people. And so, the Bhagavad Gita in contrast to Shruti, is called Smriti. The Sanskrit root Smri means to remember, and Smriti, that which is remembered, or tradition. So it's like you have these original Shrutis, and then all kinds of other literature talking about the Shruti, interpreting the Shruti, and so on and so forth. Those are called Smriti. And among all the Smriti, by far the most important one is Bhagavad Gita. Whoops, what kind of D? I can't believe that. But anyway, it's Monday. So, the Bhagavad Gita, in a sense, transcends its genre, because even though it's Smriti, it's really like as close as you can come to what you can call a Bible of Hinduism. And so people just accept it and, you know, whatever category it is. But in any case, the Vedanta, this knowledge section of the Veda, as opposed to the ritual, which is also called Vedanta, the end of the Vedas, the culmination of the Vedas, the wisdom, consists of three points of departure, or three approaches, which are the Shruti, the Nyaya, the logic, and the Smriti, and all these three together. And the Brahma Sutra has its commentaries, and the commentaries, because the sutras are so condensed, I'll give you a few of the sutras, you can see what I mean. They're so short, they're so esoteric, that without commentaries, you're basically lost in the woods. I mean, if you just had the sutras, you wouldn't get too far. So, they really need commentaries, and there are very powerful commentaries. In fact, the greatest philosophers or theologians in Indian history are precisely those, for the most part, that gave distinguished commentaries on the Brahma Sutras. So, and we'll talk about this later. Shankara, for example, Ramanuja, Madhva, and others wrote very sophisticated... And these commentaries are about as intellectually sophisticated as you can get. In other words, you can study philosophy in any culture or theology in any culture, and this is really on the highest level of intellectual sophistication. Just in order to sort of like buy into this game, you know, to get your initial chips to get into the game, I mean, you had to be an absolute master of Sanskrit grammar, which is probably the most difficult language in the world for some of you who have taken Sanskrit. When I was at Harvard, I had a professor who did his graduate work at Stanford. And he started out in classics, Greek and Latin, and then he switched to Sanskrit. And he said, as far as he could see, Sanskrit was like another level of complexity, even compared to Greek, ancient Greek and Latin. So anyway, in order to participate in this Vedanta league, you have to be an absolute master of Sanskrit grammar. You have to be a master of all the rules of logic, just like in the West. Also in India, they have an extremely sophisticated tradition of formal logic, and you have to be a master of that logic, a master of the Sanskrit language. You have to be a master of all the Upanishads. That was just to participate. I mean, that didn't mean you're going to become famous. It just meant you know, they would allow you to participate, not make a fool of yourself. And so the great Vedantists like Shankara, Ramanuja these are some of the great intellectual monuments, I think, that have been produced by humanity. But in any case, and also Bhagavad Gita. So, for example, the great Vedantists like Shankara, Ramanuja also wrote commentaries in Bhagavad Gita, and they wrote commentaries in the Brahma Sutras. And the commentaries in the Brahma Sutra basically consist of taking every sutra and saying this particular sutra refers to certain Upanishad verses. Because the commentaries of Brahma Sutra are commentaries on a commentary. The Brahma Sutras themselves are commentaries on the Upanishads. And then when you comment on or give your commentary to the Brahma Sutras, you have to identify each sutra with certain verses from the Upanishads, which means you have to master all the Upanishads. So that's what people did to, keep themselves busy, intellectual, stay out of gang-related activity. They did this Vedanta thing. So, that's basically what it is. Are there any questions on that? If not, we'll talk about, you know, what's in the Upanishads. Yes?
Can you explain one more time what Shruti and that top word means?
Shruti. Oh, Shruti.
This
word.
Yeah, that one.
Oh, prasthana means like departure. In fact, they still use this word in some Indian airports, like departure. Like the departure sign, you don't say prasthan. So, yeah, prasthan is actually the thing, this word stand. And pra means forth, like to stand forth, to depart. So it just points to departure. They're departing from different authorities, or for different sources, authoritative sources. Anything else? No? Okay. So, let's see. The people that did the Vedanta, the knowledge people, they did not always think so highly of rituals. They thought that people who just did rituals all day and never really thought very hard, that there was something superficial about that, and you're not going to get the perfection of life if all you do is rituals. So here's a typical quote from the Aitareya Upanishad. Knowledge is the eye of the world, and knowledge the foundation. Brahman is knowing. Brahman is knowing. In other words, the absolute itself is conscious and knowing. So by knowing, you are actually becoming one with Brahman in the sense of performing the same function as Brahman. Brahman is knowing. It is with this self, the Atman, it is with this self, consisting of knowledge, the essence of you as a self, as a soul. The essence of you is that you know, you're conscious. So, it is with this self, consisting of knowledge, that he went up from this world, and having obtained all his desire in the heavenly world up there, became immortal. Because remember, the Mimamsa people, who are the ritual, they're totally obsessed with ritual, absorbed in ritual, and their paradigmatic statement is, Swarga Kamo Yajeta, you want to go to heaven? Do a sacrifice. You need to sacrifice. So here, the Upanishads are saying, if you get knowledge, you actually go to heaven and just keep going all the way up to the eternal realm. And Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, we'll talk a lot about the Gita later, will say, for example, that by doing these sacrifices, you go to heaven, then you come down again. It's like, say you work hard, save your money, you go on vacation, blow all your money, you come home and start working again. And that's exactly the idea of this going to heaven. You perform all these rituals, you perform all these pious activities, you get to go on vacation in heaven, you blow your wad, you spend all your pious credits, and down you come again, and you got to start working again, start doing rituals again to pump yourself back up to that material heaven to enjoy. There's one great story in the Mahabharata, great King Yayati, a very important king, who used up all his pious credits in heaven, and his ancestors were down on earth performing their sacrifices to get up to heaven, literally saw him coming down through outer space. They saw him just floating down through the galaxy back down to earth from heaven, having used up all his pious credits. So Krishna calls this gatagatam, just going and coming. You go up and you come back down. Anyway, another feature of this Vedanta tradition is that unlike the Vedas, the original Vedas, which were divided in shakas, branches, the people from all the different Vedic schools, in other words, the Rig Veda schools, the Yajurveda schools, they shared this knowledge because the rituals, each school, Vedic school, had its own rituals, but in terms of knowledge, it was just one community. So if you were in the knowledge community, it didn't really matter which rituals you did because knowledge is knowledge. It's just like, let's say, philosophers can talk to each other, whereas, let's say, people who are very committed to sectarian religions, they may not talk to each other that much, whereas people who are more interested in theology and philosophy may actually talk to each other. So, here's another statement from the Aitareya Upanishad. Again, showing how the ritual is subordinated to knowledge. Koyangatmeti vayam upasmahe. We, in this community, we perform our worship, our ritual worship, by asking a question. And the question is, who is this self? Who is the person? Who is the self? Who is the soul? In inquiring in that way, that's the kind of worship we do. So there, again, think back to the Jains and Buddhists who are still there. The Jains and Buddhists thought, hey, we don't need all these rituals because they're kind of violent anyway. We want knowledge. We want to, you know, understand. We want to get to Nirvana or to the Jain heaven. And so they left the Vedic culture. These people, the Upanishads, are not renouncing the Vedic culture. They're simply trying to reform it. They're trying to correct it and say, look, this is the real ritual. Trying to find out who you are. That's the way you should, you know, do your ritual. And so they're not necessarily giving up all the rituals. They're just trying to transform them and elevate them,
So they're staying within the tradition. But they're addressing it by promoting knowledge. Now, another important thing, within the Upanishads, it was not just a man's world. Some of the greatest speakers of the early Upanishads were women, like, for example, Gargi. I'll write their names. Two women who are very famous, Gargi and Maitreyi, isn't it? Yes. And there were others. So here you have a case. In other words, later Hindu culture does not necessarily reflect in all ways the earlier Vedic culture. In this early Vedic culture, you have these two women who would instruct kings. You find scenes where these women, these brahminical women, would actually teach kings. And the kings have to come and learn from these ladies. And so it was not simply, it was not just like men only. That's the point. Yes?
Question about Maitreyi?
Yes.
I know about Maitreya, the Buddha.
Yeah, this is a different lady.
Yeah, but what's the meaning of that?
Well, it just comes from the Sanskrit word Mitra, which means friend. It's also the name of one of the gods. And so from the word Mitra, Maitreya, it is just the feminine form. So it's not an uncommon name. So, another example of the people, again, the Upanishad people are kind of in the Shramana tradition. In some ways, they're in the same Shramana tradition as the Jains and Buddhists, but they've stayed within Vedic culture. Still, they sometimes bash all this ritualism. Like, here's a quote from the Munda Upanishad. Which means, again, the image of spiritual life being like a raft that takes you across the ocean of material existence, an image used a lot by the Buddhists. And so this statement from the Upanishad says that these rafts, which consist of ritual sacrifice, are not very firm. In other words, this raft is not going to take you across. It's going to go down. This raft, which is consists of all these different rituals, those who celebrate this as the greatest thing to do, like those who are saying the best thing to do is these rituals, they're fools. Actually, they're confused. They're mudha. They're confused. They're bewildered. These are foolish people who simply take shelter of all these rituals without knowledge. And they will come back again to old age and death. They will not escape the cycle of birth and death. They will simply come back again. They will not get liberation by all these rituals. So that raft is their raft is going to sink, basically. So that's the statement in the Upanishads critiquing the Karmakanda section, people who just do the rituals, like Mimamsa people. This is a direct point of criticism of the Mimamsa people. Now, if you look at the Upanishads, there are older ones and later ones. And generally that analysis is done by linguistic analysis and just, you know, referencing, like if a later book talks about an earlier book, obviously the earlier book is earlier. So if you look at what is generally considered the oldest Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which the name Brihad means great. Well, I'll write it for you. Related to the word Brahman, actually. I already gave you this root for the word Brahman, breed. So, the earliest Upanishad, as far as anyone can figure out, is called the Brihad Aranyaka, which means the great Aranyaka Upanishad. And this shows very clearly that at the earliest levels of Upanishads, they were kind of coming out of the Aranyaka literature. Remember, you have the Vedas, and the Brahmana literature, the Aranyaka literature, the Upanishads. So the oldest Upanishad is also called the Great Aranyaka. Anyway, so the very first verse of this Great Aranyaka Upanishad it gives you a clue to where Jainism and Buddhism was coming from and why they kind of felt uncomfortable. So the very first verse of this oldest Upanishad refers to the horse sacrifice. There was a sacrifice in which a king would take a prized stallion and just let it roam freely for 11 months. And this horse would just wander wherever it would. And any other king who didn't want to accept the authority of the king who released the horse would have to, you know, somehow capture the horse or challenge it. But let's say the horse roamed freely for 11 months, because generally you wouldn't do the sacrifice unless you had your little political military duckies lined up. So you let the horse go for 11 months, and then the horse is led back, and it is ritually sacrificed. And that's an example of animal sacrifice. The horse is sacrificed. Of course, there are statements in the Rig Veda, the oldest Veda, telling the animal that you are going to heaven. That actually through this sacrifice, it's not, we're not just killing you, we're actually, you're going to take another birth in a very high realm. But still, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad begins, Om Usha Ba Ashasya Med Yasya Shirak Surya Chakshu, etc. Om, it starts, you know, the syllable Om. And then the dawn is the head of this sacrificial horse. The sun is the eye of this sacrificial horse. So it's seeing the anatomy, the horse's anatomy, as somehow having cosmic symbolism. So the dawn is the horse's head. The eye, the sun is the horse's eye, and so on. Still, at this time, say thousands of years ago in India, people are reading this and thinking, yuck. That, you know, I don't think I really want to practice religion by attending ritual killings of horses. And this is the kind of thing they're revolting against. And so you get Jain movements, Buddhist movements, and also Upanishadic movements. The same things that the Jains and Buddhists are doing, other people are doing within the Vedic tradition. They're the Vedanta people. And it has an effect, because if you follow, if you read the Brahminical literature and follow it historically, the influence of Jainism, Buddhism, and this sort of revamped Vedanta tradition is that instead of killing a real horse or some other real animal, they start making these sort of like little, you know, like gingerbread horses or, you know, something. They make these little animal horses out of grains, and so they replace the animal with some kind of vegetarian offering in the shape of an animal. And so it's having an effect. And so the later Upanishads, these earliest Upanishads, they're into the rituals, but they're interpreting the rituals, and they kind of condone the violent rituals. But then you get later Upanishads that say, well, wait a second. We have to get away from these violent rituals. It's really about knowledge. It's not about... So there is an evolution even in the Upanishads. Another point I wanted to make is that you find in the Upanishads the seeds, a lot of the seeds of Jainism and Buddhism. For example, I wrote on the board sometime in the past, in the near past, that in Buddha's second sermon in the Deer Park, he says there are these different skandhas. There are different skandhas, layers, coverings, which we falsely take to be the self. They are rupa, the visible form, and remember all of them, vedana, our sensations, our feelings, sangya, the way we tend to define the world, and sanskara, our deep psychology, and vijnana, sort of our final worldview. And now, these skandhas, these layers, actually... the Buddha was teaching something that was already taught in the Upanishads, and since he sort of checked out other things before he launched his own program, he probably knew about it. So again, Buddha is not simply inventing everything, he's simply giving a new twist on what already existed. So in Sanskrit, in the Upanishads, it's called the koshas, or the sheaths. You know, which are the same as the Buddha's skandhas. And so I'm going to read you a quote from the Upanishads, which basically say the same thing as the Buddha's second sermon. For example, the Aitareya Upanishad is very likely existed before Buddha taught. And it says, Jarita hridyamanas chaita tsangyanama jnanam vijnanam iti sarvani vaitani prajnanasya nama dhyani bhavanti. That all these things like sangyana, which is one of the skandhas the Buddha mentioned, the vijnana, another skandha he mentioned, all these different coverings, cognitive coverings, they are simply names. They're simply designations, conditioned designations for the conscious living being. So there's a consciousness. And the word for the conscious living being is the same word used by the Buddhists. It's prajna. Prajna. You may remember in Buddhism that they rejected sangya and vijna, but they accepted prajna. You had to get the right prefix on the gya. In other words, the idea being that there is a pure cognition, there's a pure consciousness, but then there are conditioned, illusory states of consciousness, which are still consciousness, they're just impure states of consciousness. And that exact idea was found actually in the Upanishads. So it wasn't a new thing when Buddha taught it in the Deer Park. It's just people weren't necessarily talking about it a lot on the Vedic side, but with the competition of Buddhism and Jainism, they started talking about it more. Any questions so far? The other thing is that the Jains and the Buddhists and the Mimamsa people all denied that there was a creator God. There's no God that creates the world. There's no Genesis in Buddhism, Jainism, or Mimamsa. However, in the Upanishads, there is a creator. So, for example, you have a typical statement, Atma Vaidamiv Ekivagra Asit Nanyat Kinchanamisha. So, in the beginning, the Lord alone existed and He created the world. So, you very much have this idea of creation. In fact, the Vedanta basically is, how should I put it? The basic issue of Vedanta is this, that there is a source for all existence. Everything that exists has a source. It comes from somewhere. And that source is Brahman, the Absolute. And here we are, and we are Atma, we are selves, or souls. What is our relationship to the Absolute? If we come from that Absolute, are we one with it? Are we just, like if you take the sun and the sun rays, in a sense you could say sunshine is not different from the sun, it's just another part of the sun. So are we one with that Absolute? Are we different from the Absolute? What is our status? How do we exist? Are we the Absolute? So it was these kinds of issues that people were trying to figure out in Vedanta. But they all accepted that there's a source of everything. Whereas in Jainism, remember, you're a jiva, just a soul, and then you become sort of like your own omniscient thing. In Buddhism, now Buddhism started out saying there's no God, but frankly, the bodhisattvas, you start getting things like the omniscient Buddha, it creeps back in. People like the idea of an omniscient divine being. It has traction, you know, for spiritually minded people. And so, what you find is that even in Buddhism, as it merges back into Hinduism, there's Buddhism, come rushing out of the Vedic tradition as this revolutionary, heterodox tradition, like, down with the rituals, forget the Brahmins, no caste system, and, you know, forget all this stuff, very revolutionary, very radical. But over time, market forces, the same demand is there on them as on the Hindus, and so after centuries and centuries and centuries, they come up with their own heaven. They have the same gods as in the Vedas. It's just that they put the gods, same Vedic gods, but they're just one world below the Buddha, right? If you become a pure Buddha, an omniscient Buddha, or a Bodhisattva, you're in the highest world, but just below you, your neighbors down the road, are the gods. Which gods? The Vedic gods. And they start getting all the rituals. They have all the same rituals. They start puja. They start worshiping. You can see, actually, anywhere in Japan, China, and India, where the Buddhists have these little altars. They get their altars, they do their puja, they have their little deities. So it basically becomes, it sort of goes right back to its matrix, right back to its source. But in any case, so you could arguably say, although they may not, that they do start to dabble in ideas like a creator. They certainly have an omniscient Buddha. In Jainism, you know, the jiva becomes omniscient. So the idea of an omniscient divine being that somehow saves people in this world, everybody kind of buys back into that. Another thing I wanted to mention is that as Buddhism starts going back toward Hinduism, most people in India thought, well, wait a second, if we're going to do the same thing anyway, why not take our oldest literature? Because this is where we come from. And in a culture which is always looking back, even the Buddhists, they're looking back. They start discovering within their tradition infinite past times, like past Buddha lives going back thousands and millions of years and cosmic cycles that go back forever. So they definitely end up with a universe and a time frame which is like the Vedic one. And so since everybody agrees that ancient is great, you know, old is gold, like old thing, because the real knowledge, the real truth, whatever it is coming down since time immemorial, and people tend to gravitate back toward the Vedas because that's the oldest literature. And everyone knows that's very old, whereas the Buddhists and Jains start writing literature which they claim has now been rediscovered, but is actually very old. Whereas on the Vedic side, there's literature which even physically is that old. And so, again, the Vedic tradition just starts, it has this power of gravity, and everything just starts coming back into orbit around it. And that's actually what happens. So you have the Buddhists or the Jains who say, trying to escape this very powerful gravity. But in time, everything starts coming back within the gravitational field of the Vedic tradition. And I think that's a simple way to explain it. So, now I wanted to read you a few, I thought, interesting statements from the Upanishads that kind of give the essence of the philosophy that's in the Upanishads. And I'm going to read it in Sanskrit just because it's been chanted in Sanskrit forever, and just you see what it sounds like. So there's one statement where Bhrigu, the great sage Bhrigu, is speaking to his father, Varuna, the lord of the seas, Neptune. Varuna is speaking to, Bhrigu is speaking to Varuna, and he says, Adihi bhagavo prameti tamho vacha jito vaimani bhutani jayante jina jatani jivanti japriyantyapi sangvishanti tad vijigyasasva tad prameti. So Bhrigu said to his father, Lord, or it's a very respectable term, Bhagavo, my Lord, teach me about the absolute truth. So this is what he says, teach me the absolute truth. And then he, Varuna, said to him, so the son says, teach me the absolute truth, and then the father said to him, Jito vayimani bhutani jayante, that from which these creatures are born, jina jatani jivanti, and by which, once born, they live, and jat priyantyabhi sangvishanti, and that which they return to and again enter at the end, tad vijigyasasva, understand that is the absolute truth. That from which everything emanates, that by whom everything is maintained, and that in whom everything again comes to rest. Know that that is the absolute truth. So this is really essential Vedanta. And we'll talk more about this. I actually chose this verse because it actually summarizes the first three sutras of the Brahma Sutras. Remember these guys, the Brahma Sutras, which explain the Upanishads? And or the Vedanta Sutras. And so the first sutra says that, don't write it. Anyway, do not memorize it anyway. The first sutra says, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, which means now then the desire to know the absolute. That's all it says. Now then the desire to know the absolute. And then, Janmadhyasya Jataha, from which birth, etc. And the third one, Shastra Joni Twat, because Shastra is the source, because scripture is the source. So what this means is, now then, we try to understand the absolute truth because Vedanta is for those people who have understood you're not going to get the highest perfection of life at Walmart or even at the Oaks Mall or, well, not necessarily. You know, they may have some nice spiritual books there. But anyway, let's say just trying to get money and buy things and enjoy and be physically beautiful in the world and everyone likes you and everything and all that and you're very popular and all that. In other words, life based on the body, it's not that that's evil necessarily, but that alone is not going to give you the highest perfection as a soul. That's not your highest perfection. So if someone has understood that, now that you've understood there's more to life than just indulging your body and your vanity, now that you've understood that, try to understand the absolute truth. And, of course, in this verse I just quoted you from the Upanishads, the son says to the father, teach me this absolute. The son realizes, you know, I want to understand the highest truth. Then, the second Vedanta Sutra is Janmadhyasya Jataha, birth, etc., from which means the absolute is that from which everything arises, is maintained, by whom everything is maintained, into whom or into what everything merges. And so that's what this verse talks about. The absolute is that from which imani bhutani jayante, these creatures are all born, by whom they live, and into whom they return. And then the third Vedanta Sutra is Shastra Jonipa, because scripture is the source. In other words, if you want to understand the absolute truth, you ultimately need to go to these books of knowledge because that's where the knowledge is. That's where the authoritative knowledge is. And if we try to speculate by our own mental, unaided mental and intellectual power, at a certain point, you run out of gas. And if you want to go beyond that, you need to hear from great sages and authoritative books. So these are the first three sutras, which in its, and all these points are in this Upanishad verse. So that shows you how the sutras are trying to explain Upanishads. Because this verse, which I read you from the Mundaka Upanishad, which means the Bald Man Upanishad, they have funny names. Anyway, the Bald Man Upanishad said that, had all these three points. I want to know the Absolute, and then you find out the Absolute is the source of everything, and then, and the knowledge is coming from a Shastra, from an authoritative source. So that's an example of how the first three sutras of the Brahma Sutras are, in a sense, talking about what's in the Upanishads. A few more minutes. There's another statement which I found very interesting, which is found in two Upanishads. The reason I selected this one is because you will find in the book, the books you have to read, that there's often this impression that Vedanta is impersonal, in the sense that the goal of Vedanta is to give up your ego, give up your individual, personal self, and merge into some type of corporate spirituality, so that you are no longer a free individual person. You're just not an individual anymore. And that is not actually what the Upanishads are necessarily teaching. There is a teaching of oneness, but there's also a very powerful teaching of a personal God and eternal individual existence for the soul. And because that sometimes is overlooked, I thought I'd bring that out. So here's an example of a verse which is quoted in actually a few different Upanishads. Nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitananam eko bahunam jovidhati kaman. That there are many eternal beings. In other words, eternal means spiritual, temporary means down here in this world. It's like Nagarjuna, the great Buddhist philosopher, said, in the material world, everything is temporary, therefore nothing is real, everything is empty because nothing is permanent. But here the Upanishad said there are eternal things, and there's a plurality of eternal things. There are a plurality of eternal conscious beings. But among all of them, one is most important because that one is satisfying all the needs of the many. So there's one supreme conscious eternal being among a plurality, among many eternal conscious beings. And tamatmastam jenu pashanti dhira. And those who realize, those who understand that supreme soul within themselves, that supreme self within themselves, they actually become wise and they achieve everlasting peace and so on. So, then again, going back to the Bald Man Upanishad, that was from the Katha Upanishad and the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which means the White Mule Upanishad. People back then amused themselves. So, there's a very famous verse quoted in several Upanishads, which is a very important part of the Vedanta tradition, which says, Dvasuparanasayujasakaya samanam briksham parisat swajate, which means parisa swajate, that there are two birds. Suparna is the word, which literally means fine feathered, fine wings. So there are two birds together. These two birds are friends, and they're together clinging to the same tree. Two birds were friends together in the same tree. Tayor anyak pipalam sadati. One of the birds is trying to enjoy, it's a fig tree actually, pipalam. And one of the birds is eating the sweet figs of the tree. One of the birds is eating the sweet figs of the tree. Anashnan anyobicha cha kashiti. The other bird is not eating, anashna, is not eating, and it's simply, the other bird is observing his friend. Two birds in a tree, one of them is like trying to eat all these fruits, the other one's just watching and not eating. Now, the idea is, here's the explanation of what that means. Samane vrikshe purushoni magno nishaya shochati muhyamana jushtang jada pashit yanyam isham asya muhyamanam iti vita shoka. That means that the bird who's trying to enjoy the sweet figs of the tree, that's us, the individual soul. The tree is the material world. and the individual soul is trying to exploit, trying to enjoy this world, trying to eat the fruits of this world. The witness bird, the bird that's not eating and just watching, is God. And God is in that same tree just watching his friend, the individual soul, trying futilely to enjoy this world. And it said that that individual soul, the bird that's trying to enjoy the fruits, is constantly becoming confused and is lamenting because the bird doesn't really have the power to enjoy all the fruits. In other words, the bird is trying to enjoy but always becoming frustrated, lamenting, never actually able to satisfy all his or her desires. And the other bird is just watching this. And then finally, that jushtam jada pashati anyam isham, when the bird that's trying to enjoy the fruits sees his friend or her friend, when that bird trying to enjoy actually turns and sees that my real friend is sitting next to me, and that that real friend is the Lord, then that soul, and recognizes the greatness of his or her friend, then that soul becomes free of all unhappiness. It's a very simple and powerful image. And again, this is a very influential metaphor, which is found in several Upanishads, that we are trying to exploit them, enjoy the material world. The reason we're frustrated is because we're not meant to enjoy dead matter. We're actually meant to enjoy our relationship with God. And that when we stop trying to exploit the fruits of this tree and turn to our real friend, of course the idea is sitting in the heart of the body, that real friend, that's when we become happy. So that's an example of the kind of knowledge which is taught in the Upanishads. And anyway, any questions on that? Okay, we'll stop there.